This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1977, President Jimmy Carter took office at a time when national dialogue about the role of women and gender equality dominated the headlines. In that same year, the first National Women's Conference was held in Houston, Texas. Early in his term, President Carter established the first National Advisory Committee for Women. Since departing the Oval Office more than three decades ago, President Carter has continued his efforts to end the abuse of women and sexual discrimination through his organization, the Carter Center. His latest book, A Call to Action, looks at the challenges women face in the new millennium. Former President Jimmy Carter joins us now. President Carter, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's good to be with you and all the folks around North Carolina. Thank you.
In your book, you write about the time as governor. It's a story that I found compelling. I want to talk about the criminal justice system first off. You talk about the time when you were governor of Georgia and you were asked by one of your cooks at the governor's mansion for a loan. Tell us that story.
Well, she came to me after we'd been in the governor's mansion for a couple of months, and she said she wanted to borrow just a few hundred dollars so she could get out of prison. She had been in prison, I think, for 4.5 years, and I couldn't understand what she was talking about. And so she showed me a document from a judge in one of the counties in Georgia that she had been sentenced to 7 years or $700. And since she couldn't raise the $700, she was very poor. She had been in jail for 4.5 years. So I arranged to get her the money. And I didn't have to pay it. But when I questioned the judge and his district attorney in that county, they said it was all just a mistake. But that was typical of the things that were done back in those days, particularly with black or African-American women. And now, since I left the White House in 1981, we've seen the number of black women in prison increase by 800%. And, of course, we now have seen about seven times as many people in total in prison in America. So we have the highest percentage of our citizens in prison of any nation on earth.
What do you think is happening? Because the part of the story of that woman who asked you for money was that she had actually been convicted of killing her husband, a man who had apparently threatened her and beaten her regularly. And one day, in self-defense, she stabbed him to death. She's sentenced to a $750 fine. I mean, in some ways, all of this is his life worth $750? Is there no right to defend yourself? The criminal justice system in this case seemed to be a failure, and yet, as you say, things have only gotten worse.
Well, they have. It's much worse all over the world now. And the Carter Center, which is in Atlanta, founded by me and my wife, we have had programs now in 80 countries on earth, and we've seen in all of our programs, mostly in health, in the health field and agriculture field and so forth, human rights, that women are mistreated much worse than I ever dreamed when I was governor or even when I was president. In the United States, it's a terrible situation with women. We pay female workers about 23% less than we do men workers for exactly the same job. There is a gross abuse of women in slavery. The U.S. State Department is required by law now to make a report on international slavery or human trafficking every year. Last year, they reported that 800,000 people were sold across international borders, and 80% of these sold into slavery were girls being sold into sexual servitude. And they also estimate that 100,000 girls are sold in the United States to be sexual slaves, to be forced to work in brothels or whorehouses. So this is the kind of thing that goes on now that it may have gone back in those days, but not like the international slavery trade, because what's happened is in some of the countries, the girls have been killed by their parents. If a country like China or India has a limit on the number, on the size of families, the parents believe that they can be better off in their old age with boys growing up so they can take care of them. So when a girl is born, they strangle her. And now with the recent advent of sonograms, they can tell if a developing fetus is going to be a girl, and if it is, then they abort the fetus before the female is born. So these are the kinds of things that exist throughout the world, some of them still in the United States.
You've painted a complicated picture here because some of what you talk about certainly rest with cultural traits and our cultural issues, others legal and enforcement issues. But how much of it is systemic? And is there any way in which a country like the United States can apply some leverage in a global economy to make any kind of changes?
Those kinds of laws have been passed by the United Nations, both the Security Council and the General Assembly. And most countries have ratified these laws that were designed to protect women, but the United States refuses to ratify them. So there's a convention on the elimination of discrimination against women, known as CEDAW, CEDAW, and most countries, including China and others, have ratified these treaties to protect women, but the United States Senate refuses to ratify this convention. There's another very important law called the International Violence Against Women Act, and the United States also has failed to pass that law, although a number of efforts have been made in the last few years. But the U.S. Congress is very reluctant to pass anything of a treaty nature if it was originated in or near the United Nations. It's just an aversion of very conservative members of a U.S. Senate to ratify things of this kind. This results in our own country of very serious abuses. I've already mentioned the slavery in our country, but I would say that the worst prevailing sexual abuse in America is on the university campuses, and that includes Duke and Durham and others in North Carolina, as well as Emory University in Georgia, where I teach, Harvard and Yale. And here the incidence of sexual abuse is obscene almost. Only 4% of the rapes on college campus are ever reported because the presidents of the universities and the deans and so forth don't want their university to get a bad reputation. So they advise a girl who's been raped, don't report this. Let's just deal with counseling. We don't want to make a legal case out of it because you'll be embarrassed on the witness stand. And furthermore, that a boy who rapes you will claim that it's consensual sex or that you were wearing provocative clothes or you had too much to drink, and it's very seldom that you get a conviction for a rapist. And the same thing applies in the military. The military defense department year before last in 2012 was required to make a report on sexual abuses in the military, and they reported 26,000 cases that were reported under duress or requirement from the U.S. Congress. Only about 300 of these ever resulted in any punishment for the rapist or the abusers. So this prevails in our country, and of course if it does in wonderful institutions in America like universities and military, you can imagine how much worse it is in other countries.
What do you think has to be done? Let's stick with college campuses. What has to be done to bring down that rate and to create a better environment on college campuses?
Well, I, as I said, I've been a professor at Emory University in Atlanta for now 32 years. And Emory has taken very bold action to do away with this high incidence of sexual abuse. There is a Title IX law, as you may remember, that was passed originally to give girls equal chance, girls students equal chance at sports. And now the U.S. Department of Education has ordained that if a university doesn't take corrective action correcting these abuses, then federal funds can be withheld from the university, even considering funds going for research and development. So this is a new development that can be done, but I think the best thing for the university to do without waiting until the federal government forces them to is to address the issue forthrightly and convince the student newspapers and the student governing bodies, the elected officials of the students themselves, convince women to report the sexual abuses when they take place, and then actually punish the young men who are the rapists, because when they get from high school into college campuses and realize that they can rape a girl and get away with it, they become serial rapists. And the statistics show, the U.S. Justice Department statistics show, that half the rapes on a college campus are done by boys who are repetitive or serial rapists. And I don't see why any university would want to keep that kind of young man on the campus as a student.
And what about in the military? What do you think the resolution of the case of General Sinclair sends? What kind of message does that send in the military?
Well, that sends a very bad signal that a man can get away with abuse of a woman and do it with impunity. what needs to be done is what the Senate tried to do just 2 weeks ago. They introduced a bill to take away from the commanding officer any authority over deciding whether or not a rape case should be pursued. And Senator Killebrand from New York State is in the Senate. She got 55 votes in the Senate, but as you know, it takes 60 votes now in order to avoid a filibuster, so she couldn't quite get to 60 votes. But the military objects to that. I was in the military for a long time. I was in 2 battleships and 3 submarines. I was a submarine officer. I was authorized to command submarines. And I know that commanding officers, like college presidents, are very reluctant to reveal that under their command on a ship or in a company or battalion that sexual abuse is taking place. So they excuse the rapist and discourage the women from reporting when they have been sexually abused. So we need to change the law and to take away from the commanding officer any authority over obstructing such an accusation or the pursuit to justice.
Now I'm talking with President Jimmy Carter. His latest book, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And we will continue that conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. My guest, former President Jimmy Carter. His latest book, Jimmy Carter, A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And President Carter, a large part of your book focuses on violence against women, as we've talked about earlier. And there's an argument that this type of violence is a symptom of a larger problem, and economic disparity has a lot to do with it. Should we be looking at poverty as a part of the bigger solution?
Well, that's another example, yes, that the people in power almost inevitably try to preserve their authoritative position and deprive other people for challenging them for better jobs and for equal pay and so forth. I think I mentioned earlier that in this country, women get 23% less pay for the same kinds of jobs. And I've seen that disparity grow between rich people and poor people just since I left the White House. That difference between the richest people and the poorest people has more than doubled in that period since I left the left public office. And this goes on constantly. We also have a horrendous shift to punishment rather than rehabilitation of those who violate the law. When I was governor, for instance, we had a competition between me and the governor of North Carolina and South Carolina and Alabama and so forth on who could have the fewest people in prison. Nowadays, the challenge seems to be who can have the most people in prison. And there was one person per 1,000 in America in prison when I was governor. Now there are more than 7 times that many. We have the highest percentage and the highest total number of people in prison of any country on earth. And this, again, is just an example of how we don't want to rehabilitate those who make a mistake, but to keep them in prison. We have over 3,200 people in prison now for life sentences that have never committed a crime of violence. And as you know, we're the only country in North America, in this hemisphere, as a matter of fact, and the only country in NATO that still has a death penalty. The United States still insists on having a death penalty, although, in my opinion, it's counterproductive. I think it creates more violent crimes than it prevents.
Well, let's stay right there. You talked about a lot, but let's take that last point, that the death penalty, in effect, sets an example that it creates a more violent atmosphere. You believe that? Why so?
Well, there's no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, I quote in the book very carefully preserved statistics that show that when an execution takes place in a state, say Georgia, for instance, then for a week or two before and after that, the crimes of violence in the state increase. And I quote almost every state in the nation that shows that when two states are adjacent to one another in the south or north, east or west, the state that has the death penalty imposed has a lot more murders than the state next door to it that doesn't have a death penalty. And we know that Canada, for instance, did away with the death penalty, I think, back in 1962. Last year, they had about 560 murders. The United States had something like 16,000 murders. So all the statistics that I quote in the book are very accurate, and they indicate that we are more inclined in this country than almost any other country in the developed world to punish people rather than try to rehabilitate them and give them another chance. Another very serious problem with the death penalty is it's almost invariably levied on minorities, African Americans and Hispanics, and particularly on the perpetrators of the crime when the victim is a white person. And we know that retarded people, those who have mental defect, and minorities are the ones that suffer most in prison, length of prison, solitary confinement, and also more extreme punishment like the death penalty.
And the largest single factor, of course, that correlates to this exploding prison population that's given us the highest percentage in the world is poverty. So powerlessness and incarceration seem to go hand in hand. They're correlated, and this at a time when, as you pointed out, we have an unprecedented gap in wealth. Those at the top have, I suppose, a good reason to keep people who want a piece of power out of the system, out of the vote, even keeping them unable to vote in many states because of their incarceration.
Well, we've seen that happen. In fact, I read the New York Times earlier this morning. And there's another article there about nine states that are red states and they don't want to turn blue, where the legislature in the states and the governors are doing away with as many rights as possible for poor people, older people, and minorities to register to vote. That's correct. And I guess that's a human trait for anybody that has a superior position to want to retain it and to push the other people down who might want to challenge them for equal rights. So it's a tragedy. It's not addressed. But I think the worst example of that abuse on a global basis is by far the abuse of females, of girls and women.
We talked about in your book as well, you talk about the power of religion and how, in your mind, it has been misused to preserve privilege for those who already are in power. Talk about that, please.
Well, I'm a Christian. I teach Sunday school Bible lessons every Sunday that I'm home in Plains, Georgia, at the Baptist Church, about 35 or 40 times a year, ordinarily. And I know that in my own belief, when I have a problem with some particular verses in the Bible that might want to indicate that discrimination or hatred is permissible, I turn to the actions and words of Jesus Christ. And I would say that of all the characters in the Bible, Jesus is the one that most always has exalted women and treated them at least as equals and more often as special preserved people because they were abused. And, of course, we know that almost all religions have as a generic theme peace and justice and fairness and humility and service and alleviation of suffering. And so when anybody tries to use Bible verses to prove that women are inferior, I think they are violating the exact meaning of the Holy Scriptures, although you can find in the 36,000 or so verses some particular verses that might appeal to you, to your belief, if you want to be superior to women.
In your book, you talk about severing your ties with the Southern Baptist Convention. Was that a difficult decision for you?
Well, it was. I had been a Southern Baptist for 70 years. I was a Sunday school teacher, a deacon. My father was a deacon and a Sunday school teacher before me. And I was very active in the Southern Baptist Convention at near the top level. And in the year 2000, the Southern Baptists voted that women should, in effect, be inferior to men. And they ordained that women couldn't be pastors or deacons or chaplains in the army or military. And also they passed a rule that in some of their seminaries, where the higher level of religion is taught, that women couldn't teach men if boys were in the same classroom. And because of that and a few other things, my wife and I decided to withdraw from the Southern Baptist Convention. And we now belong to, a more moderate church in Plains, where we have had women pastors, and my wife is a deacon, and so forth. So we treat men and women equally in our church.
You draw a connection between pay inequality and religious thought. What is that connection?
Well, pay being inferior for women is something that results, I think, when a man who might be quite religious, as religious as I am, when he reads a verse in the Bible and says that women are inferior to men or should be subservient to men, it justifies his selfish desire to benefit financially from it. So if he has a company and employs 20 people, he says, well, if women are not equal in the eyes of God, why should I pay them equal pay? So that's one of the justifications, which I think is false, that men use to derogate women in any way.
You know, a couple days ago on this show, I talked with Jane Smith Patterson, who served Jim Hunt in his administrations as governor of this state, and she was in the vanguard of women's rights. And in fact, she even met you at the Democratic National Convention in 76. And she talks about, she and her colleagues, other women, talk about having to push, even progressives like you and progressives like Jim Hunt, who I know you know very well, on the issue of women's rights. In some ways, your hearts and minds were there, but they had to take you kind of the extra mile to push for those regulations, changes even in the Democratic rules that opened the way for women. How have things changed? Talk about the landscape when you took office for women's rights, how they've changed since, and this leads to the bigger question of how do you get people, even who think they're thinking right, to move to the next level?
Well, when I was elected president, just 3% of the members of the U.S. House and Senate were women. And we had practically no federal judges who were women. And I started a campaign as president to increase that percentage. And by the time I left office, we had five times as many women federal judges, for instance, as we had in all the previous presidents of the United States put together before I came in office. And I tried to exalt women as well in other very important positions inside the cabinet and also as appointment to ambassadors and important positions to indicate that I had confidence in women to serve as well as men in all aspects of government affairs. We still had a problem in the United States with not getting the Equal Rights Amendment passed. My wife and I worked assiduously on that, along with Betty Ford and others who had been in the White House, to try to get states to ratify it. As you know, the Congress of the United States and the House and Senate both passed the Equal Rights Amendment for women with a two-thirds majority, which was not easy to do. But we couldn't get three-fourths of the states to ratify the amendment. And so we still don't have women's rights guaranteed as equal in the U.S. Constitution.
Well, what do you say to people who will tell you that, look, we've got women in high places now. We can see them in cabinet positions. We can see them as CEOs. We don't really need to have sort of affirmative efforts to put women in these places anymore. We've achieved that. Now we can move on and be blind to gender.
Well, let's just look at the office holders. If you take the local, state, and federal law offices and compute the percentage of women that hold those offices, it's only 18%, which ranks us 78th in the world. 77 other countries have more women in public office, elected office, than do we. And if you look at the major corporations in America, in the Fortune 500, which is 500 corporations, only 21 of them have a woman CEO, chief executive officer. And those chief executive officers get about 42% less pay than men in the CEO position. So that just indicates very clearly that the discrimination exists and is quite gross for our country. We rank quite low in the whole world as far as a equal treatment of women compared to men. As a matter of fact, the top country in this hemisphere happens to be Nicaragua. And Nicaragua is exceeded by Iceland, the Scandinavian countries, and Switzerland. The United States ranks 23rd overall. And one reason that we rank that high is because we have so many women in higher education. As a matter of fact, about 57% of all the graduating students from the undergraduate and graduate levels are women. But if you look at the tenured professors on campuses, you get down, again, around 23 or 24%. So, you know, we do rank very good on giving women a chance for education, but then when they graduate, they're still deprived of equal rights.
So what do you think is the barrier, and what would it take to remove those barriers?
Well, some countries have passed laws requiring that certain percentages of women chief executive officers and women serving on corporate boards have to be a certain percentage. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and some of those. And they have worked fairly well. But I think that the main thing is just to make sure that we have an attitude in our country with the revelation of how bad it is. And that's the reason why I believe this is the most important book that I've ever written in my life, because I don't think many Americans know that we have a massive degree of female sexual slavery in this country. I think most people don't know that the university campuses and the military are the hotbeds for sexual abuse. I don't think many people know that women make 23% less than men for the same jobs and those kind of things. So I hope that my voice on this radio station and the people that read my book and share its facts with other people will bring about some changes.
Well, people who are tuned to this radio station now will hear your voice, but political influence goes far beyond that, and it can be paid for a price. I wonder what you think about the influence of money in politics. Certainly, we want to arrest people who take a bribe because we don't think money should influence politics. So if you took a bribe and used your place in your high position, we'd want to throw you in jail. And yet Citizens United allows the wealthiest people and the wealthiest corporations unfettered access to the political process. How do you feel about the influence of money in politics today?
The Citizens United decision was the stupidest thing that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever done in history. I think it has had a major role in derogating the quality of our free enterprise system and also our political system in this country. Now there's an unlimited amount of money that can be poured into campaigns if the contributors think that they can get an equal benefit once their chosen candidate gets in office. And this has resulted in a massive amount of money being spent on campaigns for governor and for president and for U.S. Congress and so forth. And a good portion of that money is spent on negative commercials designed for one purpose, and that is to tear down the reputation of your political opponent. And although most Americans say they don't like negative advertisements, it works. And quite often we see that shape the identity of the people who go to Washington is the one who had the most effective and most expensive campaign to destroy his or her opponent. And it also is exacerbated by the fact that when a state legislature and a governor gets in and dominates from one party or the other, then they start gerrymandering the congressional districts to make sure that certain districts are completely Republican in a Republican state, and that all the minorities, for instance, are put in the other few districts to give the Democrats a few, and vice versa. I'm not just criticizing Republicans or Democrats. So these are the kinds of things that have happened. And when the candidates finally get to Washington, they're so polarized that there's no harmony there, no cooperation with each other between the Democrats and Republicans. And it's much worse than it was when I was there. When I was president, we had a very harmonious Congress. I got just as much support from the Democrats as I did Republicans and vice versa. And I had a very high batting average. I had the highest batting average with my proposed legislation in any president since the Second World War, except Lyndon Johnson. But now that's all changed for the worse. And I think the main problem is the advent of enormous sums of money.
I want to switch gears a little bit here. Last week you made headlines saying that you don't use email anymore because you think the NSA is monitoring your email.
Well, I use emails for most things still because it's so convenient. But if I want to send a private message to somebody, say, in a foreign country or even in this country, for the last few years, I just handwrite the letter or type it up on my machine, and then I mail it through the mail, because I have known now for 8 or 10 years, well, not that long, 5 or 6 years, that almost every phone conversation and almost every email conversation, I think every one of them is, in our country, as a matter of fact, is captured by the NSA, and they claim that they don't actually read the messages, but they just record who made the call, to whom it was made, and how long it lasted. And then, if they go back and get permission from the so-called FISA court, which is now kind of a rubber stamp outfit, then they can actually read the text or the wording of your message. So I think this is a very serious violation of basic civil rights that Americans enjoyed in the past, but we don't enjoy anymore.
President,
I'm not paranoid about it.
No, it's, I don't, no, it's been in all the papers.
I mean, we know
the NSA's been doing this, so yeah.
Well, sure, they admit that they do it.
Yeah, you know.
And they deny that they read the messages.
Right.
But I think that the revelations that have been made lately show that they have had a very liberal or permissive legislation passed, primarily by the intelligence committees, who have access to secrecy. And most of the members of the Congress can't even read what's in the bills that they approve. And then once those legislative acts are passed, the NSA, it's been shown, greatly exceed what the Congress really intended for them to do. After the revelations were made by Snowden and others, as you remember, President Obama appointed about a 40-person Blue Ribbon Commission to give him recommendations, which they did, designed to tighten up this constraint. And my hope is that he will issue executive orders and go ahead and put those recommendations into effect, rather than just let the Congress debate them and then maybe not pass them after a few months or a few years.
But all of this is happening, the executive orders, the fact that Congress might even be debating this because of the revelations of Edward Snowden, should he be pardoned? Did he do us a favor, or do we hold him accountable to the law as it's written?
I don't think there's any doubt that Edward Snowden violated actual laws of the United States. So I think he has to face a potential punishment. But I think that it's been maybe beneficial to our country. I'm not talking about any damage to our security apparatus, with which I'm not familiar. There may be some damage that I don't know about it. But I think it's been a beneficial thing for our country to have to face the facts that these things have been going on in a secret way, that have been a major intrusion onto the privacy of every human being that lives in the United States.
President Carter, great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, sir.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
President Jimmy Carter is signing books on his new book, A Call to Action, today at Quail Ridge Books. For more information, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the future of storytelling in the digital age. Stay tuned.